Just this past week,
the news media have reported at least 4 cases of domestic violence, including both sexual and physical abuse of women and children. Then, in this past week as well, our attention was drawn to trafficking in persons.
Mm-hmm.
Where and we issue our congratulations also to Ms. Brooms and her organization for being as vigilant and resourceful, courageous in a certain sense, to have done what they did to expose and to bring to light, for correction hopefully, this particularly dastardly form of human slavery. And then also in this very last week, we had a case where it was reported that at least 15 young men below the age of 14 were involved as laborers in the gold fields on terms only they and the people who took them there would know. These are perhaps just tips of the iceberg. Time frame for reporting on them, just 1 week. One can only but imagine how widespread the issues that were raised concerning these isolated cases of men beating women and children, ladies being trafficked, and children having to be committed to labor. The UN Secretary General, I think, was in 2010 in Barbados, declared that there should be an assault against these forms of generally domestic violence was the theme, and there was an action plan which was supposed to have been put in place by all adhering members of the United Nations system, and even those who are not part of it. Now, we once again, even as our sensibilities have been assailed by some of the most recent issues of domestic violence in the press, have decided to return to this subject once again. Two of our panelists, fortunately, sat with us 2 years ago as we looked at this question of domestic violence. The two who were with us then are Ms. Danuta Rizik and Mr. Vidyaratha Kisoon, social activists par excellence, people
yes.
who have stood out as being in part of our social conscience. And then we have, on this occasion, Dr. Faith Harding, herself, a psychologist, early childhood educator, former minister of government in education, and concerned parent and activist, who will join us on this occasion to talk to the first part of this two-part series on the subject: are women and children at greater risk? In part one of this series, we will be treating essentially with this scourge of domestic violence. One cannot let this go by and not use this medium as an opportunity to push back, as it were, against this almost intractable problem. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Spotlight.
Thank you.
Now, let me just ask a question. And this is set against the background that Ms. Mendonza of the Guyana Human Rights Association describes the situation of domestic violence, both sexual and physical violence, as a pandemic in this country. Now, pandemic, It's not just an epidemic now, it is pandemic. What are your comments on that observation? Who will start?
I agree with her. I think it's really quite a correct way of describing what is happening in relation to domestic violence in Guyana. Pandemic, it's also chronic. It has been going on for years. Obviously, we are not as yet, or at least we do not as yet, have the right programs, approaches in place to tackle this issue, right?
Vidyarata, you agree?
I agree with Dinuta. Certainly, in the 13 years since the Domestic Violence Act has since the Domestic Violence Act was passed, it's as though nothing has changed and that things have gotten worse. Worse in the sense that that means there's a whole new generation of people who would have now entering into relationships, and the cycle seems to be continuing.
Let's lay bare once and for all, at least your views. Is it just the case that, has this always been with us, this whole question of domestic violence, or is it that reportage has become far more acute, and because people are more aware of this thing now through the reportage, that we are seeing more cases before our very eyes?
I think what is often reported is when it ends up in murder. Serious injury or murder. Now, where the original statistics, just our own experiences and our own histories talking to one another, we use the word pandemic because in every one of us, we all know somebody or more than one person, our own families, our own histories, have had violence, and the way we deal with that violence is a kind of denial. We don't even use those words to name it and so on. But we mightn't have had deaths. We mightn't have had, within the last 50 years or so, the number of murders and so probably wasn't as high. But certainly now you're seeing an intensity in terms of the murders, in terms of the injuries, the chopping off of limbs, etc. But certainly in our history of violence, we've had domestic, we've always had it. But I think there are probably limitations to where people, things are kept secret. Of course, awareness has also brought more reporting. But when it's, whatever the issues are, it's there.
Yeah. I think, Faith, even as you offer a response, I wonder if you would also include a stab at the question of, is there some commentary that can be made about where we are going as a society?
Definitely. We're becoming more violent. We are, although lots of women have got a voice now, where through places like Help and Shelter, Red Thread and other organizations, their voices are being heard about domestic violence. It's always been with us. It's a way of human interaction where from one's culture or one's religious basis, where the man was head of the household, where the man was told that to discipline anybody, whether man, woman, or child, you had to hit. It's where boys went to school, and on every Friday there was a fight in school. So there was violence coming in so many ways for so many years. Always been there, but as we said, both my colleagues here said, it's more in the pandemic level. It's everybody doing it now because people no longer want to hold it a secret. Because holding it a secret also prevented it from escalating. Because I think if children didn't know that mom and dad had a fight or heard the abuse, then they would tend not to repeat that. But now everybody hears it. Everybody knows it's happening. The music that we listen to tells of the how to handle a woman and who a woman is and what she is. We're hearing about breakdown Shabbat door,
yeah.
You know, which is a violent act by itself. Anything that break down, I mean, I'm not putting any connotation, but you use the words break down. That's negative. And breaking down her back door.
Kick in.
Oh, it's kicking the back door. Sorry. I'm out of touch. But kicking the back door, I've heard it.
Which one is more violent?
I know. You know, I think kicking is more violent. And so what this does is push the violence in your face. And so you see it becoming repeated time and time again in families. And it's very frightening. I mean, we used to think that, oh, maybe it's just the poor people or somebody who is ignorant or mad or crazy or drunk. But it's in every single home, almost every other home.
Whether it's wealthy, notwithstanding.
Exactly. Status in society, it doesn't even matter.
And I think that, I mean, we're specifically talking about Guyana, but worldwide, you know, in 2009, there was a study done in all the countries, or in many of the countries of the world, on levels of domestic violence. And worldwide, the rate is one in every three women would have suffered or experienced some form of domestic abuse within their lifetimes. And in some countries, it was higher than others. So we know it's not only a problem in Guyana, but it's a problem in the Caribbean, and it's a problem throughout the world. And I think you have to understand the root causes of, or the root cause of domestic violence, and that is, it's about the inequality of women and the subordination of women, right? That is where it stems from. So when we look at our society, and I guess this is happening in other countries of the world, is that when men's power is being challenged, Faith talked about being the head of the home. So when men's power is being challenged, right, by women, as, you know, they, you know, better themselves in society, their voices are more heard, they're more visible, they're coming out of the home and they're working, they're now working outside of the home. All of these traditional roles are being challenged. And for some men, right, this is very confusing. They feel that women do not know their place, and therefore in the context of the home, right, for some men, they feel that they have to stamp their authority here, right, if nowhere else. And sometimes what in the manifestations of that is the physical violence, the verbal violence, psychological violence, and financial abuse.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Faith took us very early into this question of the association of our socialization with this state of domestic violence. Even as you were speaking the note, I was thinking, I wonder to what extent our cultural, and will include religious upbringing, may not have fixed in our minds some of these rules. And therefore the question is, what kinds of modifications you think we should be seeing, or we should be advocating, as part of our religious
norms
and dogmas, thanks for saying that, to the extent that they run counter to this state of violence and more violence. Who wants to take a step?
Definitely the language of the religions and the culture has got to change. The language, the perception, the interpretation of the Bible, the Gita, the
some of the imagery,
the whole system has to change if we're to change one's perception and expectations of the roles of both male and female. This is what is most frightening in our society. Just yesterday, I was talking on suicide, and which is a form of violence too, and often coming from the home, which acts, which comes a lot from religions, understandings or interpretations of who we are, where we must go when things don't work for us, and what we must do. And so these roles have to change. So the church and other social organizations have a great role to play. And as I said, the language of the conversation needs to change to be a little more positive. The interpretation of the beliefs, because we all interpret all our religious documents, you know, and, you know, beat the child, spear the rod, you know, beat the wife. The wife is supposed to be subordinate. What does that mean? The language has to change.
I think the other thing that has been interesting how some of the churches have been dealing with this is not only that, oh, no, this is wrong, but you must put up with it. You know, pray and stay.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is another problem. So even though some of their religious organizations have started to say, okay, we know this is an issue, but still, this thing named the family is supposed to be preserved based on the suppression of usually the woman in that family. And that is a problem. So you've got all kinds of socializing happening. You've got the man shouting on you, and the Antiguan man telling you to kick in your back door. And then you got the church people telling you that if this you're in this relationship and these things are going wrong, you should really try as hard and keep your faith and all of that, and put up with whatever this is. And remember, for many people, they think that if there isn't murder, that that extent of the violence, somehow things can be, you know, that there's always this hope of change. And so many people stay in abusive relationships for a long time. And, I mean, fortunately, I just want to make a point, though, is that I think many of the religious organizations are gradually changing. You know, there is some shift in terms of how they're trying to change this conversation. And, you know, like a couple of years ago, we're trying to do the Roman Catholic bishop here. You know, they've had a whole conversation here. And, you know, he issued an apology to all of those who've been hurt by the doctrine of staying. And you know, so it's all these kinds of conversations, all these things that have to happen. But they're not sometimes consistent because, you know, depending on who you're speaking to, you know, some of the religious leaders. I know, as I'm Hindu, you have Swami Akshayananda on one hand telling women, remember your Kali and Durga. You know, you're the supreme divine, you're the supreme feminine. You know, the Hindu religion is the one that worships the feminine. It has this interesting dichotomy. Then I go hear Pandit Sinhala about how, oh God, you know, a Hindu wife stays with her husband no matter what. So, you know, you have all these mixed messages that come at different times, which means that we have to, you know, you always have to be vigilant. I think those of us who are within religious organizations also have to work with that. Because at the same time, there are many people who use their faith to come out of abusive situations.
Mm-hmm.
And that too must be acknowledged. You know, many, you know, some women have realized that Jesus bring me. You know, you hear women speak to that as well. That the same faith that, you know, depending who they speak to.
But, yes, and I think, though, coming back to my original point, and I know sometimes people are uncomfortable with it, but if we look at all of the institutions of power in the world, look at them, right? And when we talk about what is the root cause of gender-based violence and domestic violence being one form of it, right? When you look at those institutions of power, be they the church, be they the government, be they
military,
whatever, those things. When you look at who's at the head of these things and how... what is the position of women in relation to that? Very much subordinate. And when we look at society, I mean, these kind of patterns regenerate themselves. And so this is what, you know, it's part of what is happening in Guyana, is that, you know, it's a cycle that is continuing and just moving over and over, because unless you're able to address this issue, families in which domestic violence is taking place, right, will continue because the children who grow up seeing this will
continue
the same kind of patterns of behavior. And if the cycle is not broken, their children will continue the same patterns of behavior. So in some cases, yes. And I mean, I think that this is something that is really happening in society. There is, men feel that they are abused also, and they are. No question about it, right? But I think you have to understand levels and incidences, right? Because the seriousness of abuse that's meted out to women, right? And we're talking about, you know, the serious levels of violence and so on, right? Seldom would you have that happening to men, mm-hmm. right?
I tell you what, as I indicated in my introductory comment, this is a two-part series. And on this panel, we will try to just carve out, though in fact these things are not so easily carved out because mm-hmm. everything is interrelated. The domestic violence component, as far as the state of women now as opposed to sometime in the past. But it is clear, you make a point which is going to be central to the issue of the second panel that we would put together, and this whole question of power relations, even as we look at the evolving state of women in a socio-political and economic context, and to see what we may possibly read from what has happened, even as now you've used this as an example of how that is feeding into a subculture that was ingrained and which says that, you know, the man was supposed to be in charge of the thing. Mm-hmm. And this is reinforced by all of the cultural and religious norms that we have adhered to. But I tell you what I'd like for us to do at this time is to immediately go to some of the actors and actions as far as domestic violence is concerned, because we clearly have to find some methods and or some prescriptions mm-hmm. as to some things that can and should be done. We immediately want to start with this whole question of legislation. Let's just set the framework mm-hmm. and then see what it is that we can be done. As Vidya reminded us in 1996,
mm-hmm.
The Law of Sexual Offences Act,
the Domestic Violence Act
was passed. Who wants to take it up from there? How successful has it been? What is 17 years?
Yes.
You have indicated yeah. this has been around.
I think success for the act can only be measured in terms of, I mean, the fact that the act exists in itself was something progressive at the time, certainly for all the Caribbean countries that have that. So certainly that what that did was signal that this is no longer a private matter. And it gave the remedies, it was supposed to be easy and accessible remedies, but Guyana is a place with lovely legislation and bad implementation. And the Domestic Violence Act has also suffered. I mean, very few, you know, being able to access the act is difficult, and access of protection orders, the enforcement of protection orders, the role of the police in that
one is going to be identified.
Right, but the police is always the police is all. I mean, the role of the police in that act is extremely important, and there have been discussions about the Domestic Violence Act and the amendments that need to be made. Not the amendment. I mean, some of the things that have to be done to get enforcement. Magistrates have been trained on it. But something, you know, because we don't have a system of accountability here, so like the police, in terms of holding the police accountable for issues in terms of when you're violating orders. And I don't think a lot of people understand, you know, when the further you go out of Georgetown, the more inaccessible the police become to people. When you're, you know, the courts don't operate every day. The courts are, you know, three times. It's there's a lot of things. There's a lot of talk about the family court. We've had family court discussions going on for years. We haven't got. I think the family court discussions is old. This mm-hmm. is 1995, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we're supposed to be having mm-hmm. the family court. we haven't had any, you know, haven't moved anywhere on that as yet. So having the legislation alone just doesn't, we have to watch it. It certainly doesn't, and is it serving as a deterrent? Probably. We don't know, given what is happening. Is it because of enforcement? Is it the police or not?
Yeah, so, right, because the Domestic Violence Act, the first thing that needs to be said about that is that the majority, even though this act was passed in 1996, 17 years ago, the majority of people in Guyana do not know the provisions of the Domestic Violence Act at all. They just do not know. They know there's an act. They know there's a law called the Domestic Violence Act that is supposed to address domestic violence, but they don't know how it works. And we certainly know this because at Help and Shelter for the past 16 years, we have been quite systematically trying whenever we and when we do our public education programs to explain to people what the Domestic Violence Act says and how you can utilize it. Because, as Vidya said, what is the point of having an act if you do not know how to utilize it? And for this particular act, the Domestic Violence Act, it basically it's a civil remedy. So it is you, the person who is being abused, has the power to go to the nearest magistrate's court, go to the clerk of the court and say, I would like to have a protection order. This and this happened to me. I am a victim, a survivor of domestic abuse and so on. And there's a form to fill up. And then the clerk files it and the matter will come up in court for a hearing. Whoever is the person who is the alleged abuser would also be notified, go to court, etc. But many people do not know that. It's a series of protection orders. But the majority of people in Guyana don't know this. So I think that this is so crucial because you cannot pass a law, and this is happening with the Sexual Offences Act, which is a newer law. What is the point of passing, having good legislation, right, when your population does not know how to use it, right? And because we cannot, as women, mm-hmm. right, we cannot allow just the lawyers or the DPP or the police, right, to enforce the law. The more you are empowered in knowing what your rights are, right, under these acts, the more you can use it. And that is what law is supposed to do.
Stick a pin, just so that there is a point of immediate information for our viewers. You basically have indicated the Domestic Violence Act makes provision for the approach to a magistrate.
Magistrate's court.
To the magistrate's court.
Clerk in the magistrate's court.
And seek an order mm-hmm. against
an abuser.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, and this is with or without the intervention of the police?
Exactly.
Yes, it's direct.
That's what the law says.
The law says.
I just wanted to be clear, because the next we are going to come to see the role of the police in all of this, because we are talking here about public education and the whole question of empowering people who are being abused. Mm-hmm. All right, so you could just go straight to a magistrate's court.
That's what the law says.
Yes.
That's what the law says. And
but?
However, in certainly in some areas, like for instance, it's better now, but before, like Georgetown, the magistrate's courts in Georgetown were requiring people to have an affidavit. So it meant that you then really need to engage the services of a lawyer and legal aid. The Ghana Legal Aid did a lot of those kind of applications for complainants, person who wanted to approach
it. So there's another layer there.
But I must say it has improved slightly because through UN Women, training has been done. They funded a training in Guyana for magistrates on the Domestic Violence Act. So recognizing the provisions that there really is no need to have the affidavits and lawyers and so on, etc., but it's possible. So I understand that right now some of that is happening. That the clerks, because you see, you have to train the clerks to do
as
it.
As well.
Because mm-hmm. they have to fill out these
and the
forms and know that they're empowered to do
years.
It. Mm-hmm. You see, so it
I see.
Mm-hmm. So all these people are in kind of involved in it. But it was supposed to be a quick kind of remedy, you know, so because it was to protect you if you were in immediate risk. And basically what the main order is, which is a protection order, is that the abuser, right, if you get it, if you're granted it by the magistrate through a court process, right, then that person can't come within so many feet
through a court process.
There's a hearing, a court hearing.
All right.
There's a court hearing where the case is presented, and the person who is being defined as the abuser has the right to lead a defense by himself or with a lawyer. So there's a court here, and if the magistrates agree, yes, that what is written in this court order, yes, abuse is taking place, etc., can grant it. And basically what the protection order says is that you can't come within so many feet of the person you are abusing, where they live, work, go to school, etc. Then there's some other occupancy orders, which means that you have to leave the house because the person who is the survivor has been granted the right to stay there, probably with the children, while you have to leave. And then there's a tenancy order and so on if a place is being rented.
And these are very important ones, because with the occupancy order, the man would say, but I own that house. It doesn't matter. You're being accused and it's granted. The woman is allowed to stay there, whether she owns the house, part of it, or nothing at all. She is allowed to stay there with her children.
But they're not permanent orders, right?
No.
Right, but for the period.
It's a transfer of ownership.
And no transfer of ownership.
Right. But is this about a space? Because, of course, it's supposed to be an idea of counseling, which doesn't exist either. Mm-hmm. Like rehabilitation and so on of a perpetrator.
And safety also, right. Even though, I mean, mm-hmm. when we have done our training, men, I mean, when they hear about this house, how, you know, the man has to leave, right? There's a lot of concerns expressed by them. Where will they go? If they have nowhere to go, what happens to them, etc. Mm-hmm. But what the Act says is the magistrate has to take all of that into account. But the safety of this person, right, who is being abused, and I mean, sometimes I don't think we understand how serious the levels mm-hmm. of abuse are. They are horrific in some cases. Horrific.
Yes, and this question of the occupation of the house, some of them have resulted in the houses being burnt. We've had a couple of cases in the press about where the man just burned the house down.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's not his house, so he's just going running. I mean, there are times when a woman has left and gone to her own
place.
Right,
and it might have
this is after. I mean, that's one of the things about the man. Remember, most of the escalation of the violence happens when the woman is trying to leave or has left. And mm-hmm. many times when those houses, it's long after. You know, it's after she felt that
she
I'm leaving. So there is this thing of, you know, I mean, but you know, there's a sense of despair and hopelessness. You know.
All right. Now, so we have laid bare once again the whole question of the operations of the Domestic Violence Act of 1996, which is accessible to anyone.
Well, it should be.
It says it's gender neutral, meaning
male
that men,
female.
Women, male or female. It also includes
children
all.
And right. children can be right. applied right. for under this law.
All right. Now, invariably, a lot of the people who are involved here, I mean, we have a lot of poorer people than those who can access through availability of resources. Any one of these things. As soon as you hear the courts, well, you take in lawyers.
Right.
And you're saying that there is available also.
But you got a legal aid clinic. It's in Region 6, Region 5, Region 2, Georgetown.
Which could assist the person who is being abused with the legal provisions in terms of approaching the courts for these orders. All right. The Sexual Offences Act, a much more recent phenomenon, how does that help us in terms of protecting our women and children a little bit further?
Well, it's the Guyana Sexual Offences Act is kind of seen as one of the most progressive and comprehensive laws on sexual offences in the Caribbean. So it's very comprehensive, it's very modern, etc. It's very detailed. It's a big act, right? It's not like the Domestic Violence Act. This is a big, because it takes into account a whole set of different offences, and it has expanded the offences, etc. But there were some issues with the Sexual Offences Act when it was passed in 2010, and that was they had paper committals, and it was generally known that the provisions for the paper committals, how it was set up, could be challenged, because people said it was in violation of the Constitution of Guyana for persons who are they're the perpetrators, then persons mm-hmm. who are the accused must have the right to face their accuser mm-hmm. and know what they are being accused of. And they felt that the paper committals at that time were like victim statements and eyewitness mm-hmm. statements in relation to the victim, something like that. I'm not a lawyer, but yes. it was something like that. So it eventually
it was just
challenged.
A natural justice yes, kind of right. provision
natural
that says
justice.
That a man
it was
must
challenged.
Be able
it was
to...
A challenge. Yeah.
Right.
It was a challenge.
So it was yeah. challenged, and the Chief Justice ruled that, yes, the Constitution says that the accused has to have this right. So the Act had to be amended, and it was only in...
2012.
Earlier this year, okay. January, mm-hmm. that all the amendments were in place, so it really became functionally, it really mm-hmm. became, you know, properly functional in terms of Guyana. And what that did, though, is that those cases, especially the serious offence cases like rape and so on, got backed up. Because when it was assented to by the then president, right, the old law was put aside. So if, unfortunately, you were a victim of a sexual offence, right?
Charged under the old act.
Right. That is put aside. So you had to fall under the new act. I think it was assented to in May or June of 2000.
24th of May or something.
Right. Thing, right? That was, it had to come under that law. But it couldn't be operational because there was this challenge. And so the cases were not going before
the courts,
very few. So you, when it became fully operational in early January, I think they said it was this year, there was already a backlog of cases. And, you know, that was one of the reasons for a new Sexual Offences Act. Because under the old act, you had these two-tier system. Mm-hmm. You had first had to go to the magistrate's court and have a mini-trial, as they say, a PI, preliminary investigation. Then if the magistrate found that there was enough evidence, he would then recommend
you. Mm-hmm.
to high mm-hmm. court. And sometimes that took 6, 7, 8 years, whatever. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the reasons why, you know, and a lot of people abandon these cases after they have to wait so long, you know, and go through all of this process. School children would have to miss days, months of school because there were always delays in the court, etc.
And the whole post-trauma effects of something yeah. like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
You keep reliving,
and it goes
you have
on.
To go back and relive it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, but the Sexual Offences Act was supposed to help.
It helped to relieve that.
Yes.
Yeah, but yeah. it started off with the backlog because of this challenge with the paper committals. So I don't know, but it's you have the paper committals that goes before a magistrate, but the actual trial will take place before a judge and jury. Now, we need to have more judges. Because this is the reality
of
things
system.
Because now, right, you know, we have, the courts are slow.
Yes. Vonda, hold your thought. Yes. We will come back.
Okay.
When we return, we will visit the judicial process.
Yes.
Because that is really quite important in this whole question of trying to find effective remedies to this whole question of domestic violence. And we take a break at this time. Prior to the break, that I was going to invite you to make some quick and passing commentary on the operations of the judicial system. Even as we've now got the Sexual Offences Act in front of it and the Domestic Violence Act, which has been there for some 17 years. Quick comments. With regard to, one, the workability of the Sexual Offences Act as we have seen it operationalized up to this point. Quick comment.
Well, I don't know how many cases, but I know there was a big backlog of cases because of what we spoke about before. However, to make it operational, right, once again, people need to know what is in the Sexual Offences Act, right? Because the offences have widened, definitions of rape have changed.
Like what?
Okay, for example, now, a man or a woman can rape a man or a woman, right? Before, rape was considered that only a man could rape a woman, because for rape is no consent and sexual penetration. Mm-hmm. Right? Under the Sexual Offences Act, however, what it says in terms of rape is that if any part of the body is used or any instrument is used to penetrate the sexual organs of anyone else without their consent, that will be defined as rape. So if you use a weapon, use a finger or whatever, and you penetrate either the anus, the vagina, or if you use your mouth, right, if you use your mouth on sexual organs of another person, the same kind of way, without their consent, that is also considered rape now.
Mm-hmm.
And this education has not got out to people. This information is not known. We need to have it in the schools because the underage children are engaged in sexual violence.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to get them to understand what the law says and how they could be charged. So that you, not only the schools, every police station should have it broken down for people to understand it. You need to have it in regional offices. We need to have a widespread availability of these laws, both the domestic violence law and the sexual offences law, because these are serious crimes in our society, and people don't know, people don't understand. There's a lot of fear, there's a lot of misunderstanding, mm-hmm. that is taking place. So we need to make it very clear. The education has to go out to people. The knowledge has to be given.
Yeah. Well, let's put this in perspective. If I recall correctly, the National Domestic Violence Oversight Committee flows out of the idea of the supervision of the Domestic Violence Act. Then you have from the Sexual Offences Act, you have the Sexual Offences Task Force, which is supposed to be having some oversight over the operations of this act. I'm using this now as a response and get you to talk to this whole question of this education of which you talk about, mm-hmm. Faith, that is required as a must. I mean, I don't want to be proven guilty when, in fact, I don't know that I'm
exactly.
committing
a
crime.
Yeah.
And then, put in perspective for me also, very quickly, this whole question of the commission, gender and, what is it they call it?
So there are the different constitutional commissions, the Rights of the Child Commission, and the Women and Gender Equality Commission.
Yes.
Which have a slightly different function for the Constitutional Commission to address issues when rights are violated. But they... you know, they usually, I think they're more reactive to complaints being made, and then they have to respond to issues. They have their own.
And in all of this, I think we have to add the ombudsman in a certain sense.
We have to speak to the task force. I think we should. The public should know. I mean, this is one issue.
And I'm not sure that the task force functions.
The sexual offences task force has not been convened.
Right, now the body called Sexual Offences Task Force, this is written into the sexual offences law. There's a section that talks about prevention, right? A whole section in the law says prevention, and it outlines the responsibilities and who should form part of the Sexual Offences Task Force. And they have many things that are written down there that it's supposed to do. But one of the main things is that it's supposed to come up with a national plan of action for the prevention of sexual offences in Ghana.
So part of the education program that Faith is talking about should flow directly from the operations of the national task
force. It is a multi, it's supposed to be a multi-stakeholder forum made up of representatives from ministries and from civil society, you know, and
a broad spectrum.
Yeah, and people were actually sworn in, you know. People actually were sworn in, I think, by President Jagdeo at the time, to be on this task force, but it has only been convened three or so times within since 2010 to date. And as in the article in the newspaper I read, where Merle McCormack quite rightly said, because she spoke about it, is that convened, yes, but no work has started. And we have it here. This is the law. Yes. I cannot understand what reason there is for not convening such an important mechanism, national mechanism, to deal with a national problem.
Now, Ms. Mendonça of the Human Rights Association further makes the commentary, and this is purely in response to this whole question of performance. Before these two acts, there were 346 cases of abuse that were registered. 24 were filed in the courts, and only 3 have led to prosecutions.
Yeah.
So we have almost one tenth in each case going down from the total reporting.
No, that's one tenth.
Yeah?
100%.
Yes. Well, from the time from the time you started, it's 1% of just going through the court prosecution through the courts.
So how many lead to conviction is another
matter.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, this if there was a yardstick that would say this thing is not working, that will be it.
Women and children's lives are no better.
Yes.
Sorry? These are recent figures.
No, this is a 2010.
That's correct.
Well, look at that. You see, and that was one of the reasons why we needed a new Sexual Offences Act, because it was felt the time, it was too long. Secondly, that the system that they had, right, was against, right? It made it very difficult for victims to come forward, right? The whole process was long. It didn't protect the rights enough of the victims, etc. This new law was supposed to correct all of that. So if this is still happening, we really have to look at how it's being enforced. And as Faith said, the education, because education is power. Information is power.
I'll tell you what, clearly there are so many issues here, but in the time now available to us, I just want to look at two issues. One, and that one will only have to be brief, because I think everyone recognizes the part that enforcement plays in any law. And the police is our point of contact, in essence. Somebody gets bashed in and you run to the police. Let's very quickly look at approaching the police, what rights we have as we approach the police. And what should we expect the police to do in circumstances of some violence that has been meted out?
I think the expectation is that the police would take all reports and take all to respect the rights of victims who are coming forward. And the police, the domestic violence has a dynamic, and many of the police will know that sometimes many people who are going to the police for help don't necessarily want charges to be laid, but they want a warning to be made to the perpetrator. And sometimes there's this issue where the police feel that they're wasting their time because the victims might change their minds or back down. But the police training includes this training about the dynamics so that you can still offer the support of supporting that victim through that process, right? So we expect consistent response. The police stations are supposed to have rooms in which the reports to be taken confidentially so that there's no distress to victims when taking reports. And, you know, we had asked a long time ago for the Ghana Police Force to set up a special victims unit staffed by people who are interested and trained in dealing with this area. So if you have, because remember, the police are part of our population. Many of them are abusers too. Some of them might be victims, right? So as a result, you have to work with the police through their own issues as they have to deal with reports. I mean, the police also engage in acts of violence, as we all know. So when you set up this special victims unit, people who are appropriately trained, you can then have some accountability that is clear. And we're not talking about an account, you know, after night you're running for, as happened to the girl in Sophia, the 14-year-old girl having to go through that. I mean, you know, what was that about? The police have been trained in dealing with it. That's a straightforward issue. But whether it's the callousness or just a complete lack of, or maybe the police's only experience with violence, we don't know. Right. But yes, whatever those issues are.
But you know, the training has to be continuous.
But it's going to be a monitoring of what? But yeah, it has to be a monitoring. But also, it's when you train, when you go out there, you have to put the things
into place. Put action, so you need monitoring.
All the time.
And there needs to be support to the police on this issue. This is a very serious issue. And I don't get the feeling that the system or the agency is responsible are acting as though this is a life and death situation. This is a situation that will kill not only the economy, but the social development of our people. Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at the policemen and their training, or setting up the services unit, I had recommended some years ago to an agency to which I'd done a study on sexual violence and domestic violence, that we set up centers that not only include the police, but a social worker and a counselor and a health professional. So that as a woman runs in there or a man runs in there being beaten or having some complaint from domestic or sexual violence, there is that unit in there which has both health, the social welfare,
the police,
the counseling, and the police, and they're a team.
Yeah.
That I recommended since 2010, I think.
Now,
or 2009.
Yeah. I tell you, this question of the sensitization of our police to deal in an appropriate manner, in a timely fashion, with issues of domestic violence, clearly is one that begs for much, much greater attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that at the level of the Commissioner of Police, that's something that he should be seeing as part of his mandate, given the presence of place and the concern that this thing has for the society at large. But let me, for one brief moment, because the time you also have left, we are not at this time going to treat with this whole question of the education of the role that education can play. This has been hinted at in some of your respective contributions. But in a lot of the discussions on domestic violence, the presumption always is that the man is a perpetrator,
mm-hmm.
and the woman is the one who is the abused. I did hear you all three say that it can be anyway, and in a certain sense, psychological violence and all of that has to be taken into account as in the overall scheme of things, because the underplaying of that may not help us to understand some of the causes of some of these problems. Women have a different way of physically abusing well, not physically, of abusing, period. The psychological thing, they are better at men.
I think we got to understand what the difference is. We've got the impact on the immigrants. When we have a difference of someone who is feeling nagged and irritated and annoyed because his girlfriend or wife is, you know, nagging him or whatever, that's one thing. But that's not the person who's feeling in threat of his life or running. You know what I mean?
Valid, very yeah, valid.
There's a big difference. I mean,
very valid.
We must, we must be careful when we talk.
Yes.
This is not about problems in relationships.
Yes.
As opposed to being threatened, having yes. children, hiding, fearing, yes. you know, losing limbs.
Point
so,
absolutely.
So we've got to be very
taken.
Careful. We talk about abuse out, and they're different. Yes. We have different ways of resolving. We have to learn how to live healthily in relationships.
Within the context right. of right. a society where people have not learned how to resolve conflicts yeah. by other than physical means,
right? Or assault
we have to also, I suspect, in our mitigation search, think quite seriously about those other things that, though they do not bring physical harm, they could ultimately lead to physical harm being created. The whole question of conflict resolution. But more particularly, what I wanted to, there are so many issues here. The roles of men. Nobody talks much about the role that men should be playing. Well, everybody says they are the actors. But can we, for 1 minute, talk to the question of men as helping to create solutions to these problems? They seem not to be involved. Vijay is unique in this particular
struggle. Sorry, certainly valid, because I think if the statistics are 1 in 3, I like to think that, you know, I think slightly more of us were not abusers, and therefore
yes.
what happens is our silence gives consent. Mm-hmm. And therefore it's for us men to take ownership and responsibility for dealing with this. It means, you know, standing up to sexism, it's standing up to the injustice. It might mean, you know, when a lot of us are witnessing sexual harassment on the road, and there are a lot of men, a lot of us were troubled by the fact that a school girl is walking down and can't walk down the road without being harassed or threatened by some other men who think that they're doing it to impress us, so that we have to find a way of speaking out to that kind of violence. We have to overcome our own fears that we might be emasculated in doing that. We have to redefine masculinity to include speaking out against violence. For those of us who might have witnessed abuse and violence and feel ourselves becoming abusive, it's for us to know and acknowledge that behavior and change it. And for us to also not encourage our friends. If we're drinking with people who we know are going to become abusive and they don't drink with them,
mm-hmm.
you know, let's find ways of helping our friends who, you know, we might think we drink and we are right. But the persons we're drinking with go home and they're not all right.
Yes. And right? as we fashion a response nationally, we should consciously consider including more men in some of these discussions, which ultimately lead to some form of activism about treating with this question of the
And certainly violence. The men who are leaders, as Danuta mentioned, it's men who lead the institutions of power, and these mm-hmm. men who have to be involved in these issues. I mean, our current president, you know, he spoke to the police about the issues of domestic violence recently when he was addressing, their conference, opening up the training center. And he spoke to telling the police, you know, that they must be. But it has to be translated, not only words, it has to be translated into some action.
And
where
the
men
programs.
Have power, mm-hmm. where the men have power, they have to provide the money, they have to provide the programs, etc., to deal with these issues. And it's also changing for the next generation, to change the next generation, so you don't go into... So for us to understand what healthy relationships are.
Yes. Well, I tell you, those will have to be the last words on this issue of the program which attempts to look at whether women and children are at greater risk.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This is part one. And which focused essentially on the question of domestic violence being as prominent as it is and as outrageous phenomena in our society, which really hits at our things that are sensibilities as to what is inappropriate. Now, if I hear anything coming out of this course, is the fact that one, and we didn't get to talk in details about it, is that there needs to be serious education now about this whole question of domestic violence, sexual offences, in particular in view of the new act, because a lot of people may be going around there operating as if their current state of socialization may be allowed, may be caused or considered as acceptable behavior, when in fact they may be putting themselves at serious risk under the new dispensation as far as sexual abuse is concerned. What I also hear from the discussion is that we have a plethora of legislation, but we have certainly been found wanting in causing this legislation to be made active, to be made operational, and that if there's anything that we do over the next while, is to perhaps to take pause and just make what we have currently on the books cause them to work, meaning to activate all of these provisions, nice provisions, task force and oversight bodies, and God knows, we go back to things like the ombudsman, police complaints authority, and all of these stories, yet you have the same police who you want to complain about investigating themselves. You know, kind. So I think there is a lot of tidying up that needs to be done. If one were talking to officialdom through this medium, that is one thing that I suspect I hear the panel recommending, and certainly Spotlight supports. On the other hand, I also hear a statement about taking individual responsibility in our homes, the way in which we help to socialize our children, our religious and other cultural organizations, taking responsibility for helping us through the dilemma of mixed messages about what is appropriate in the context of the relationship between men and women, and men and children, or for that matter, women and children, adults and children. I will have to let that be at this moment on this part of this program on our women and children at greater risk. I'm Grantley Waldron saying good night.